Hello and welcome to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr. Good to have you all back on board as we get ready to present some more information that you can use. So be ready to grasp all that you can, put it into play in your lives. And as a matter of fact, if you can't use it directly for yourself, think about somebody you know who might be able to use it. We have a great guest today who's going to be helping us with regards to health matters. This has to do with mental health, physical health, social health, you name it, health. Because we're going to be talking about addictions. And our guest is psychologist Dr. Angela Bethea Walsh. Dr. Bethea Walsh, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
It is truly my pleasure. I tell you what, and it's great. We're going to be having a timely conversation, so timely it never gets old. I guess especially now that, you know, we've gotten past prohibition and the sale of alcoholic beverages has long been made legal, and now various states across the country legalizing the recreational use of marijuana, and on it goes. And so we're going to be talking about addiction. And I tell you, Dr. Bethea Walsh, I know that there is just so much debate about marijuana, whether it's only good. And again, even when we're not talking about medical marijuana, when we're talking about marijuana just for recreational purposes, so many people are on one side or the other. Yes, it is harmful. No, it's not harmful. It does you some good. It doesn't do. Well, we get to straighten some of this out about addictions in general. But before we get into addictions, before we get into drugs, if we could learn a little bit more about our guest, you, Dr. Bethea Walsh, as you share with us some of the events that shaped you throughout your life, how you decided that psychology would be the right field for you. And as you talk about that, share with us how you decided that addiction would be one of the areas that you would specialize in.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really look forward to this, and hopefully that can share some pearls or some bits for people to think about. So what are some life events that affected me? Man, well, and how did I get into this field of psychology? My father would tell you that when I was in 10th grade in high school, clearly this is a long, long time ago, I told him I was interested in being a psychologist, and I don't even remember that conversation. Not to say it didn't happen, but, he's 86 years old. He's got a great memory still, so I trust that. And the way I remember it is two things. So one, when I was in high school, there is a little bit of a high school story to this. So I took a brain and behavior class. And when I was in high school, that was probably one of the very few classes that I really became interested in and learning more about the why, sort of why do people do the things they do. And I think of myself as over time in a very natural way. That's sort of how I thought about the world and people. I always had this sort of curiosity about behavior and how do people make decisions and what drives them. And so I guess when I sat through this class in high school, that provided a little bit more of a frame for how I was thinking about people in general and the world in general. And so I was very much interested in that. And then I ended up going to Howard University as an undergraduate. And I did not want to claim an undecided major. And I knew, it's almost like I chose psychology by process of elimination. I knew I didn't want to be a math major. I knew I didn't want to major in the hard sciences. And I also knew that this one class in high school resonated with me. So I decided to choose psychology. And so glad that I did it. I'm one of those people that I chose something that I love to do. And there are so many wonderful facets of the field that it never gets boring, in my opinion. And certainly the way I've practiced has changed over time in terms of populations I've worked with, areas of interest. But anyway, I would say people who shaped me along the way, certainly my parents, who supported me in doing whatever I wanted to do, really, certainly professors at Howard, because not only did I get what I think is a good, solid, basic understanding about psychology and theories of behavior and things of that nature, the one thing that those professors offered me that I didn't even expect to receive was, what are some of the contributions that Black psychologists made to the field? Uh-huh. And so really learned to be what I think is pretty well versed in that, and you know, there certainly that broadened my knowledge of other ethnic minority and racial minority psychologists who've contributed to the field, and maybe who saw some of those early theories of behavior in a different kind of way, because many of the early theories of behavior and personality were very much normed on white heterosexual males. And so that they opened up the discussion about the fact that those theories are not applicable to all people. Let's take a look at some theories that might be more specific to certain kinds of racial and ethnic groups. And so then I think that's when I started to develop my own sense of, like, man, not only am I training to become a psychologist, I'm training to become a Black psychologist and a culturally sensitive psychologist, or one certainly who is culturally sensitive in my practice.
And I know that means a lot to a lot of people, because so mm-hmm. often, you know, in your field, in many fields, no doubt, but especially in your field, trust has to exist between you and the people you're working with. And one of the ways that that trust can be developed is if they feel like they can relate to you.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And so if you demonstrate mm-hmm. that you know how to relate to them, not just because of the color of your skin, but because you understand the culture, you understand the background, and you can incorporate that in your discussions with them, I can see how that can make a tremendous difference in their outcomes.
Absolutely. I think of all therapy, also all clinical supervision, as a cross-cultural process. So I do integrate discussions of culture into my work with my clients. I also integrate discussions of culture in my work with people I supervise, because it's already there. And there are many clients over the years who I've worked with who, especially when I'm wrapping up treatment and we get into this process of ending and we talk about what was it like for you, you know, we might have touched on it from time to time. What, if any, thoughts do you have about working with me as a person of color or African-American woman, or, you know, whatever that, or heterosexual woman or whatever that is. And sometimes people are like, I didn't really think about it. You know, they say that. And some people say it really resonated with them. And some people will say, this is why I chose to work with you, because I thought you would understand where I'm coming from. I thought I would be able to connect with you. I thought I'd be able to trust you. There'd be a sense of safety here. And maybe there's something about my experience that I wouldn't really have to explain to you, assuming, you know, you kind of already know what it's like, you know, given your demographic variables or how, you know, how you are as a African-American woman or what have you, that I wouldn't have to explain to, and usually they discuss the example of having to work with a white therapist. So that's huge for people. And I do integrate that into discussion with people from time to time, and certainly as processing and wrapping up treatment.
That is so interesting. Yeah. So mm-hmm. that being the case, you mentioned that you see your practice is cross-cultural. So in addition to working with people of African-American descent, do you also work with other cultures, other ethnic groups?
I do, yes. And in fact, I would say my practice is usually, on average, about half white, half people of color, or I would say racial ethnic minorities. So, yeah, I get a mix. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I see, in terms of racial and ethnic diversity, I certainly see that in my practice.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Mm-hmm. And so, and you brought in another piece of that, that I had not really, I thought about it in the past, but not recently, and that is the gender issue. The fact that you're a woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and so I would also say that the majority, pretty much at all times, the majority of clients in my practice are women, and that really is very reflective of larger scale trends. So for the most part, study after study tells us that women are more likely to one outside of the family quicker than men do, or just in general. So mm-hmm. I'm not too surprised to see that in my practice. And many women come to my practice saying, you know, I intentionally chose a woman again for the same reasons, that knowing that I'm or, you know, a member of that cultural group that they could relate to me in that way, and that maybe they think that they could connect to me in a way that they couldn't connect to a man. And I have an open discussion about that, too. I think there are some situations where it can be very helpful for women and corrective for women to work with another woman. I also think there are some situations where there are some women who would like to work with a woman, and I actually think they would do better therapeutic work and have a more corrective experience with men, just depending on what their background is. So I talk with people about that, too.
You mentioned that. I tell you, I remember, I guess this must have been Dr. Bethia Walsh, maybe 20 years or so ago. I was in a class where I was, it was a rape crisis course. And I was being trained for that because I wanted to be able to help people who had gone through a rape event. And one of the points that was made to me by one of the ladies, I think one of the trainers, was that women really needed to see women when they were in a situation like when they were victims of that situation, because men were a man more than likely was the one who had perpetrated the crime against them. And my response was, I understand what you're saying, but aren't there times when women really need to be working with a man who would be sensitive to what they're going through, and it may be helpful to them to be able to get in a therapeutic situation with a member of the very gender who had hurt them, so that that could help them with the recovery, as long as they weren't traumatized by going to a male who would, male volunteer or a male therapist who could help them work through that? What are your thoughts about that?
I absolutely agree with that thought. That it, so people have done research over time about MeSH, and there's something to say about, sure, there are many, there's some clients who like to see themselves in me, or, you know, it's interesting what people bring to therapy, or say, you know what, I wanted to work with a black, like, female, like, or black woman psychologist, because I wanted to work with someone who, you know, in their mind seemed accomplished and whatever. So people often choose a therapist based on what their hopes are, based on how they want to be different. And sure, I think that someone who culturally is very different, who's demographically very different, can also do very good therapeutic work with, you know, a client who's culturally or demographically different. So if there's a man who is very much aware of his privilege, very much aware of, or, you know, checks any sort of sexist beliefs or has worked through that and practices in a way that is very, very sensitive to the person's needs and can provide therapy that's very corrective for that person, why not? There are people, racial and ethnic minority individuals who do very good therapeutic work with white therapists. You know, there are white therapists who are allies. There are white therapists who have maybe might be more advanced or developed in their racial identity development. So they get it when they at least understand when a person of color talks about microaggressions in therapy. You know, I walked into a store and someone followed me all around the store. There are many white allies and therapists included who can understand that and guide a very good and effective conversation around that and help the person to work through whatever. And, you know, same thing with other sort of matches there across cultures. So I say, sure. There's no guarantee that even an African-American therapist is going to be his or her most effective with an African-American client. There's also variability within cultures. So, you know, you could be working with an African-American therapist who's sort of behind in their racial identity development. You know, these are the folks who my friends would joke about and joke around and say, you know, the Blackfoot people, if we were, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that was on social media last year. If black folks were to leave the United States and go to back to Africa, who would they take with them and who would they leave here? And it's usually the people who people think are more or like less advanced in their racial identity development. So anyway, I certainly think that it comes down to preference and it comes down to consciousness and how therapists can be their most helpful to people, and particularly people who are different from him. I mean, in my opinion, that's the ethical thing to do, is to be able to work with people who are different from you as well.
I hear you. Wow. That is so interesting. Well, just if I could ask you one more question, just before we get into addictions, you have touched on this so much. In fact, I was just amazed when you mentioned the brain and behavior class that you took in high school. I was kind of jealous, to be honest. But
like, that wasn't my high school.
That's right. But I wanted to ask you if you could give us just a brief breakdown of what psychology is, and we'll go to break after that, and then we'll come back in and start talking about addiction. But first, if we could just get a brief overview of what psychology is about.
Mm-hmm. Psychology is really the understanding of what's inside of someone. So sociology looks at the study across groups, between groups. Psychology, we look at, in general, how the study of how people think, how people behave, identity, how people think about themselves, how they think about the world. And that's sort of a very broad brush stroke of the study of psychology. And I would add to that, especially with a cultural twist, the effects of cultural worldview on how we think about ourselves, how we think about the world. It can certainly be multiple layers. And in terms of addictions, well, I guess we'll get to that in a second, but that's how I think about the study of psychology, study of organizations. There's a whole subset of, or subfield of, industrial organizational psychology. So helping organizations and systems be healthier in terms of how they function. And so it really does have layers of like individual, and, you know, could be something to do with organizational work, could have something to do with cultural work as well. But in general, and so there could be, so there are so many different ways to practice psychology, whether that's therapy, research, consultation, supervision. I mean, that's just naming a few, evaluation, assessment.
Pretty broad.
To support individuals and organizations, and any sort of, you know, cultural group sort of evolve and thrive in the world, and you know, work through any problems, decrease suffering. So that's sort of like how I would describe it.
Yeah.
Take a shot at it.
Very powerful, powerful field. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you all now, when we talk about addictions, Dr. Bethia Walsh has walked us through what generally psychology is about. You've heard her discuss some of the factors that kind of shaped her and brought her to where she is. We're going to be focusing on addiction. So between now and the time that we get back with you in just a few minutes, I want you to be asking, what really is addiction? Is it just attitude disguised as something that we call addiction? What is it? Is there a way to treat it? Is there a way for a person to truly overcome addiction? Are there different types of addiction? We're going to be talking addiction in just a few. You all stay with us. Our guest, yours and mine, Dr. Angela Bethia Walsh, and I will be right back.